This is podcast number 189 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm bringing you part two of the introduction to Catch the Vision of the Well-Educated Heart. Denmark lifted itself by its bootstraps. But perhaps there wasn't so much to lift. A little country, a mere handful of people. Why, 40 or 50 folk high schools did the job for 4,000 or 5,000 students each year. Suppose you had 4 or 5 million students to think about. Suppose you had 4 or 500 million people to worry about, all of them 1,000 years behind the time, all of them poor, almost none of them able to read a page or to write his name. How do you go about educating that many people? If Yang Chuyen had thought of that, he might never have started his revolution. But he didn't. Not at the beginning, anyway. It all began rather by accident, this Yang Chuyen mass education movement that was to make such a stir not only in China but all over the continent of Asia and in the island countries of the Pacific. It began when young Jimmy Yen, the students at Yale College had called him Jimmy and the name stuck, went over to France with the YMCA right after the First World War back in 1918. He had had the good luck to get over to America for an education, Jimmy Yen, and now he wanted to see if he couldn't do something for his fellow countrymen. There were a couple of 100,000 of them over in France, brought all the way from China to take the place of soldiers who were fighting in the trenches. They were called coolies, which means peasants and working men, and they were simple and poor and ignorant, doing what they were told to do, and feeling pretty lost so far from home and from their wives and their children. One day one of the coolies came to Jimmy Yen. Please, would he write a letter for him? A letter to his wife? Needless to say, coolies couldn't write. Only scholars like Jimmy Yen could write. And no wonder. China is probably the hardest language in the world to write. You have to know 30,000 or 40,000 separate syllables or signs to write it properly. It's hard enough to learn the 26 letters of our alphabet and how to put them together to make words and how to spell all the words right. Even now you sometimes make mistakes. Suppose you had to learn 40,000 different signs or words before you could read and write. No wonder the coolies came to Jimmy Yen and asked him to write their letters for them. Mr. Yen wrote the letters all right, and then so many of his countrymen came to him that even if he had sat up all night every night writing letters, he couldn't possibly have finished them all. He had a better idea. Why not teach the coolies to write their own letters? Was it really necessary to learn all 40,000 of the signs or syllables in order to read and write? Couldn't the Chinese alphabet, no, that's the wrong word, couldn't those Chinese signs be simplified so that even coolies could learn to write their own letters? What a sensible idea, and how odd that no one had thought of it before. James Yen set himself to simplify the Chinese language, and after a while he got it down to only 1,000 syllables. Even 1,000 is bad enough, heaven knows, but if you work at it, you can learn 1,000 different signs for your words. Actually, you recognize that many yourself without bothering to spell each one out at each time. You don't really have to spell out E-A-C-H to get each, or T-I-M-E to read time. If you look at a word often enough or long enough, you get used to it, just as you get used to a face, so you don't have to stop and make sure that the eyes and the nose and the mouth all go together. So James Yen taught some of the coolies to read and to write, and as soon as one of them had learned, he would go off and teach two or three of his friends, and then they would go off and teach their friends. It was like a chain letter or a chain reaction. Soon there were hundreds of coolies over in France who were writing their own letters. If you could do that with the Chinese in France, why couldn't you do it with the Chinese in China? So in 1920, Yang Chuyen, better give him his Chinese name back again now, went home to China with his big idea and his big heart and started a revolution. He didn't mean to start a revolution, but that's just what he did all the same. For once the Chinese peasants were able to read and write, they would be able to do almost anything. Once the Chinese peasants could read and write, things would never be the same in China again. But what a lot for Mr. Yen to do before he could get started. Have you ever thought of all the preparation that has gone on just to teach you to read? The hundreds of years of working out an alphabet, inventing a printing press, working out the right spellings for words and the right grammar, making dictionaries and spelling books and reading books, training teachers and setting up schools and libraries, all just so you can read. And in China, nothing. No alphabet, no dictionaries, no readers, no schools, no teachers. Nobody had ever thought of teaching Chinese peasant boys and girls to read. Reading was for scholars, as in Europe, hundreds of years ago when, if you were lucky, you would learn to read and write in Latin. Reading wasn't for peasants, and reading certainly was not for girls. Dr. Yen, for he was called that now, had to select his 1,000 words, then write his own readers and spellers and get them printed, then build the schools and train the teachers. Even then he was not finished, for he had to go out and persuade the Chinese peasants that they ought to let their children go to school instead of working in the rice fields. What was still harder, he had to persuade them to go to school themselves. But he did. Dr. Yen was quite a persuader. Before he was through, he persuaded millions of peasants in many countries that they ought to go to school. He persuaded learned professors to go out and live in mud huts with their pupils. He persuaded the Chinese government to buy land for its peasants. He persuaded the United States Congress to give him $27 million for his work. They wanted to give him more, and he had to persuade them not to do that. Dr. Yen started in the province of Hunan, in the middle of China, and he started by going right out to one of the villages and living in a mud hut, just like the villagers. For he had already learned what Pastor Grundtvig and Christian Kold had learned, that you have to start with the people themselves by going out and living with them. That is what Dr. Yen did, and his wife, too, who was the daughter of a Chinese minister in New York. And pretty soon, 60 men and women from the universities, students, and even professors, came out to join in the great experiment. And there was another thing that old Pastor Grundtvig could have told Dr. Yen if he had been there to tell it. It is this, that education cannot be separated from the rest of life. It is no more a thing apart than your brain is apart from your body. You cannot educate children if they are at home sick. You can't get their parents excited about schools if they haven't enough to eat. You can't find teachers if war has come along and swept them all away. You can't build your schools if the men in your town won't turn in and help put up the school building and dig the well and do all the other work that is necessary before you have a real school. All of these things, schools and health and food and roads and water and the goodwill of the village or the town, are tied together in a single package. But if all the difficulties are tied together, so are all the benefits. So Dr. Yen went all over China spreading his mass education movement until over 800 villages had joined it. It was like a snowball. Whenever Dr. Yen or his teachers had managed to train 10 or 20 young men and women, they would in turn go out to nearby villages and teach 10 or 20 more boys and girls to read and write. They would do more than this. They would teach them how to bring the soil back to life, and how to dig wells deep enough to get pure water, and how to protect themselves against illness and disease, and how to work together for the common good of the village. Dr. Yen and his teachers and helpers were doing what nobody had been able to do for 4,000 years. They were breaking down the great wall of ignorance that had cut the Chinese people off from the modern world. Then came the World War. In 1937, Japan invaded China, and from then on there was nothing but turmoil and misery and poverty and war. The war went on for 8 years, and after Japan was finally defeated, poor China was plunged into a civil war that went on for another 7 or 8 years. So for 15 years, China did not know peace. Dr. Yen kept right on as best as he could, teaching teachers and working a way to wipe out and introducing modern methods of farming. He even started a college near the wartime capital of China, deep in the West. In the end, the communists drove out Dr. Yen and his teachers and workers. That was a pity, for he was changing the face of China. If they had let him alone, he might have done many of the things they wanted done, without all the war and the death. But what he had done was not lost. What is done is never wholly lost. All those millions of peasants who had learned to read and write, all of those farms with new water flowing down from the hills, all of those babies saved from malaria and from the cholera, that was something. All those minds that were opened to the sun, all those lives that were saved, nothing could change that. Dr. Yen had no idea of stopping just because he had to leave China. He moved on with many other Chinese to the island of Formosa and started up his mass education movement there. Then on he went to the Philippine Islands with his great crusade. Here it wasn't so much a matter of schools and education. After all, the Americans had put in schools way back 50 years earlier when they took charge of the Philippine Islands. But after 5 years of war and another 10 years of poverty after the war, there was much to do even in the Philippines. Dr. Yen used the same methods here that he had used in China. He went to the villages, little collections of huts tucked away in the outlying islands and almost forgotten by everybody except the people who had to live in them. In each of them, he started what he called a wiping out program. Wipe out ignorance, wipe out disease, wipe out poverty, and he got the young people of each village to carry on the work. He had thousands of posters printed and put one of them up in each of the villages of the islands. Go to the people, live among them, love them, serve them, plan with them, start with what they know, build on what they have. Not so different from what Bishop Grundtvig and Christian Kold had said back in Denmark 100 years earlier. There's one thing you can be sure about children and about schools and about education, and that is that the job is never done. You are one of the lucky ones. You know how to read, or you wouldn't be reading this book. And you live in a society that is rich enough to have schools and libraries and books. You live in a society that is rich enough to let you go to school instead of sending you out into the fields to work. Even after all the work of men like Friedrich Froebel and Horace Mann and Domingo Sarmiento and Christian Kold and Dr. Yen, even after all that, it is still true that most people don't know how to read. You do, of course, but China is at least 3 times as big as your country. That's pretty safe because China is 3 times as big as every country except India. And most people in China still don't know how to read. Or in India, or in Indonesia, or in the Congo, or in Brazil, and many other countries. Just think. Most people in the world still can't read. And just think, in many countries of the world, they still haven't discovered children. Curious how everybody seems to get the same idea at the same time. For hundreds and hundreds of years, nobody seemed to worry because the peoples of Asia and Africa and South America couldn't read or write. Education, so one might have supposed, was for white people only. Then, just the other day, everybody woke up to the fact that all those millions and millions of men and women with black skins and brown skins and yellow skins were people too. Why not worry about them for a change? If it was a good idea for white boys and girls to go to school, why wasn't it a good idea for black and brown and yellow boys and girls to go to school? If it was useful for the men and women of Europe and America to know how to read and write, why wouldn't it be useful for the men and women of Asia and Africa to read and write? For a long time, people in Germany or England or America had said, education is for everybody, but they hadn't really meant it. They had only meant that education was for everybody in their countries. Now people were saying, education is for everybody, and they meant everybody. There was Dr. Yen over in France, discovering that simple Chinese coolies could learn to read and write, and hurrying home to China to spread the good tidings. And there was Dr. Frank Loback, preaching the gospel in the jungles of the Philippines. Now he had made the same discovery, and he was getting ready to spread the news all over the world. Frank Loback hadn't planned to be a teacher. He had planned to be a preacher. The teaching came by accident. Well, not wholly by accident, of course. Things hardly ever do. He had always wanted to be a preacher, but not an ordinary preacher. That was too easy, and he liked things to be hard. He wanted to be a missionary, but again, not an ordinary missionary. He wanted to be a missionary in the hardest place in the world. He read that the hardest people to convert to Christianity were the wild Moros on the jungle island of Mindanao in the Philippines. So, of course, he got himself sent out there, and he quickly found out that, sure enough, they were the hardest people to convert. So hard that he stayed there for years and didn't convert a single one of them. He didn't even make any friends. That saddened him. Then one day he had a kind of vision. Why should the Moros like him or accept the religion he preached? After all, he didn't really like them, and he certainly didn't accept their religion. In fact, he didn't even know their language. Imagine an Arab coming to your hometown and trying to convert you to the Mohammedan religion by talking to you in Arabic. He wouldn't get very far, would he? He wouldn't get a bit further than Frank Loback got with the Moros there in the jungles of Mindanao. So the Reverend Frank Loback decided on two things. First, that he must learn to like the Moros, really like them. That meant he would have to live with them and live the way they lived and be interested in the things they were interested in. And that meant, of course, the second thing, that he would have to learn the Moro language so that he could understand them and talk with them. But how? Nobody had ever bothered to write down the Moro language. In fact, there wasn't even a Moro alphabet. How do you set about learning a language if there isn't any alphabet and if there aren't any written words? That really put Dr. Loback to the test. It was just the kind of hard problem that he liked. He solved it, of course, and with the greatest of ease. He wrote the alphabet himself. Then he wrote out the words of the Moro language. Imagine inventing an alphabet. Imagine inventing a written language. For that was what Frank Loback was doing. Now everybody was delighted, most of all the Moros themselves. These fierce warriors who had terrified all the other Filipinos on the island were like children with a new toy. Now they all wanted to learn their language, learn to read it and write it. So next, Dr. Loback had to invent a way to teach it. He managed that, too. He always managed everything he put his mind to. He did it by drawing pictures of the sounds and writing out the words next to the pictures. But that was only the half of it. The other half was to encourage the Moros to learn, and he did that by what you might call the glad hand method. A warm handshake, a pat on the back, a gleaming smile, and at every sign of progress, more handshakes, more pats on the back, more smiles and laughter. It all worked like a charm. But of course, Dr. Loback couldn't teach all the Moros to learn their language. That would have taken a lifetime. So, like James Yen over in France, he hit on the idea of making each of his pupils into a teacher. He called his method Each One, Teach One. Each one who learned the Moro language would go out and teach it to one other Moro, and he would teach it to still another, and so on, until everybody had learned. It was all that simple. When some of the Moro tribesmen hung back because they didn't want to be teachers, one of the chiefs came to Dr. Loback's help. He was a very important chief, too, so important that he had 13 wives. Everybody has got to teach, he said. If he doesn't teach, I'll kill him. That helped. In no time at all, most of the Moro men were able to read and write. Then off Frank Loback went to other parts of the Philippines, to remote corners where no missionaries had ever been. Everywhere he went, he discovered new languages, dozens of them, and he drew up alphabets and made lists of words and drew pictures that looked like the words. And everywhere he used his Each One, Teach One system. And lo and behold, pretty soon almost everyone was reading and writing. By now the fame of Dr. Loback had spread all over the world, Every mail brought him a new invitation to come to some new country and teach the native peoples how to read. So off he went, to Malaya, to India, to Ceylon, to Java. That was 20 years ago, and Frank Loback has been going ever since. Up and down the great country of India with its dozens and dozens of different languages, and to the neighboring countries of Pakistan and Ceylon as well. During the World War, he went over to the West Indies and into South America, to ancient Yucatan, to Peru, to Brazil, and then after the war back to Asia and Africa, to the countries on the Mediterranean, on the Indian Ocean, on the Pacific, a white-haired old man with a battered suitcase and a portable typewriter conquering the world. Remember Thomas Paine said, "Where liberty is not, there is my country"? Frank Loback might have said, "Where learning is not, there is my country." Everywhere he went, he used the same methods that he had used with the Moros back on the island of Mindanao. He had an artist with him now, and the artist would draw the pictures of words and sounds, and then write them out, and in no time at all, people who thought they couldn't read a word were reading school books. Sometimes Dr. Loback had to write the books too, just as Dr. Yen had to write the books for his Chinese readers. But that didn't worry him at all. He liked to write books. And everywhere he went, he used his chain letter method of each one, teach one. Before he was through, he had taught almost 60 million people to read. Remember the story of Mr. Chips? He had started teaching in a little English school as a very young man, and he went on and on for 50 years, teaching the sons and the grandsons of his first pupils. And when, as a very old man, he lay dying, he heard someone say, "What a pity he never had a son." And he raised his old head, and his eyes flashed, and he said, "I had thousands of them, thousands of them." Think what Jimmy Yen and Frank Loback could have said. Millions of them, millions of them. So much has changed in our world in the 60 years since this brief history was written. Our access to knowledge and information today is unprecedented. Access to education around the globe has drastically improved. But is there room for something more? A better way to make use of all these modern benefits? The education of today determines the world of tomorrow. If you don't like what you see going on in education, I hope you have caught the vision of what just one ordinary person with an idea and some courage can do to change the face of education and the world in a big way. By small and simple means are great things brought to pass. I believe a mother is a child's most influential teacher, and I believe many things are in place that will make it possible for this generation of mothers to do something extraordinary. You read of millions of lives influenced by one man. What could 100 or 1,000 mothers accomplish? The very foundation of our national life is laid in the home, and the wife and mother is the center, the mainspring of all true home life. Our wives and mothers have as yet hardly entered the outer chamber of the beautiful edifice of the ideal home of the future. It is the Holy of Holies. And in it lies the very secret of human progress. The highest civilizations have scarcely as yet glimpsed the possibilities of home. If these ideas have resonated in your heart, I invite you to watch the videos on the homepage of welleducatedheart.com and then continue your journey by taking the free Catch the Vision introductory course. You will see a link under the Well Educated Heart video. It isn't that any of this is difficult, but it requires that you see learning through new eyes, which takes time and diligent effort. You cannot speed grow a garden. Seeds of ideas must be planted, nourished, and harvested, and my purpose is to plant lots of new seeds of thought, seeds that I have been gathering as I have studied the writings of heart educators who were inspired by the work of Pestalozzi and Froebel, who believed education should be a delight. You will also notice a section called Libraries of Hope. You'll need lots of heart-stirring stories, music, art, and poetry to teach your children this way. So a free library of gardening tools has been provided. Some years ago, I had a dream. I dreamed I was standing in the middle of a large, crowded hall. There were no windows or doors. Several times a day, all of us would sit at one of the long cafeteria-style tables that stretched down the middle of the hall, where we would all be fed the same thing. It wasn't a bad life. It was normal for us. Then I noticed a door I hadn't seen before. Curious, I walked over to it, looked around to make sure no one was watching me, turned the doorknob, opened the door, and slipped outside into a hazy fog. I could hear the sound of horse hooves off in the distance that were coming closer. Soon a horse-drawn carriage appeared and stopped in front of me. A tall, lanky man stepped out and beckoned me to follow him. He smiled at me, and his eyes were so warm I didn't feel afraid at all. I practically had to run to keep up with him. At first he didn't say anything to me, but after a while he introduced himself. He said he was Hans Christian Andersen. Just then the fog broke, and I found that he had led me to the most glorious meadow you can ever imagine. All around, as far as the eye could see, were flowers of every shade of color. White, billowy clouds floated across a deep blue sky, and I felt the warmth of the sun on my face. Butterflies fluttered among the scented blossoms, and the breezes carried the songs of hundreds of birds. I could barely breathe. It was so beautiful. My friend held out his hand and motioned for me to lead the way along the path that now meandered through this glorious meadow. At first, I was anxious. I was going to miss my 2:30 feeding time. What would my peers say? But soon, the joys of the meadow so filled my heart, I didn't care. The two of us spent all afternoon in the meadow. My friend patiently waited while I stopped to take in each new sight and discovery at every bend in the path. Then, just as the path ended, he said that he had to leave me. We were standing in a grove of tall trees, and concerned, I told him that I didn't know where to go from there. He simply smiled and looked heavenward. God directs. Suddenly the scene changed, and I was back in the noisy, crowded feeding hall. Immediately I was surrounded by angry peers. Where had I been? Didn't I know I had missed my 2:30 feeding time? I told them I had just spent the entire afternoon in the most glorious meadow with Hans Christian Andersen himself. I wanted to tell them more, but they rolled their eyes at me in disbelief and left me to myself. But it didn't matter. All the joys of the meadow were stored in my heart, and I knew it would remain with me always. The dream ended, and I woke up. Maybe it was just coincidence, but a day or two later at a library used book sale, I happened to walk by a shelf of books, and one title caught my eye. The Fairy Tale Story of My Life by Hans Christian Andersen. I didn't know anything about his life. I had only read his fairy tales. I didn't remember having previously seen his picture, but there on the cover was an image of the friend of my dreams. I opened the book to read the first page, and at the end of the first paragraph he had written, "The history of my life will say to the world what it says to me. There is a loving God who directs all things for the best." I, too, believe in a God who directs all things for the best. On the cover of this little book is the painting of a young woman gazing over a beautiful scene. Our big, wide, wonderful world has so much for us to explore and discover if we have eyes to see, ears to hear, and hearts to feel. I have been on this path for many years now, and it has brought so much joy into my own life. And I've received letters from mothers all over the world who have experienced increased joy and light in their homes and lives as they have applied the principles of the well-educated heart. I invite you to continue with me on this journey of discovery. This is my wish for you, that the spirit of beauty may continually hover about you and fold you close within the tenderness of her wings, that each beautiful and gracious thing in life may be unto you as a symbol of good for your soul's delight, that sun glories and star glories, leaf glories and bark glories, flower glories, and the glories that lurk in the grasses of the field, glories of mountains and oceans and little streams of running waters, glories of song, of poesy, of all the arts, may be to you as sweet, abiding influences that will illuminate your life and make you glad, that your soul may be as an alabaster cup filled to overflowing with the mystical wine of beauty and love, that happiness may put her arms around you and wisdom make your soul serene. This is my wish for you.